Well, thanks very much, sir. It's a pleasure to be in with you on Sunday night. What a blast to start the week with you on Sunday, the first day of the week. And it is. And now it's also Monday in some parts of the country, so you get it both ways. It's the first day of the week, no matter how you look at it. You know, going back to our first-time guest, it was very interesting with David Simon. Some people are saying, leftist, horrible leftist, he wants more taxes. Let me tell you something about leftists and taxes. The rightists were doing it back when I was a child. I was barely coherent. However, you know what the tax was on $1 million when Eisenhower was president? 900 grand. So anybody, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle they're on, trust me, they're going to get the taxes if they want it. And the other thing is about the, Sandy says, no, bacon doesn't cause diabetes, carbs cause diabetes. And I remember my friend Masood. He said, have lunch with me. I said, what, here at the office? He said, yes. I said, okay. And this guy was like 70 and looked about 45. And his family came in because they were all involved in his company and the family business. I said, you know, Masood, your family is beautiful. Everybody looks so young. What's the deal? He says, it's primarily diet. I said, it's this Mediterranean thing. It's the diet thing, isn't it? And he's like, yes. I said, well, there's hardly any. I mean, I see lots of vegetables. Is that what you attribute your good health and you know, your skin looks great, or everybody's just glowing? He said, we all like meat, but even when we were kids, we would have meat, but it would be just a little bit, like a couple of 3 tablespoons of it on the side of the plate, and we would save it for last. So everybody likes meat, but just got to go easy on all that stuff. All right. Now coming up, this is going to be fantastic. This is David Brin coming up. He hasn't been on the program since January 9, 2002. He is a scientist. He is a speaker. He is a world-known author. His novels have been New York Times bestsellers, winning multiple Hugo, Nebula, and other awards. At least a dozen have been translated into more than 20 languages. Existence, his latest novel, offers an unusual scenario for first contact. His ecological thriller, Earth, foreshadowed global warming, cyber warfare, and near future trends such as the World Wide Web. A movie directed by Kevin Costner was loosely based on his post-apocalyptic novel, The Postman. Star Tide Rising won the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novel. The Uplift War also won the Hugo Award. So stand by, because coming onto the bridge of the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM will be the one, the only, David Brin. Stand by. David Brin, where have you been for 14 years? And welcome to Coast AM.
Oh, it's great to be back. I've been exploring the cosmos, and I just got back. And boy, are my arms tired.
I'll bet. You know, the question is, what if the 21st century begins in 2014? They seem to have missed the birth of Christ by 6 years, so we don't really know what we're doing here, do we? And
that was just a little article that I threw out as a New Year's gift for everyone. Bloomberg picked it up. You know, the notion that we're very, very good at pattern recognition. We look up in the sky and our ancestors saw gods where there are just little bright lights. And, you know, back in 2000, we saw pattern recognition in those double zeros, that triple zero in 2000. And I just pointed out that, you know, there's a little bit of pattern recognition having to do with when the theme of the last couple centuries actually began. Turns out around the 14th, 15th year has been really crucial historically for at least 600 years now. But it really became significant around 1814 and 1914. 1814 was when you saw the end of the Napoleonic era. It was the end of the French century. And all of a sudden, in the peace negotiations when Napoleon was defeated, Europe entered its longest period of peace that it had ever seen. Oh, there were still wars, but they were pretty small and pretty under control, and mostly the European countries concentrated on building their colonial empires and having a huge industrial revolution. And the result was that by 1913, There was a huge, huge optimism all over the Western civilization, Europe, America. People were getting things that they had never imagined they could get. Early refrigerators, radios, automobiles, the iron bedsteads so they could sleep off the floor away from the vermin.
Yeah.
Their kids were going to school. Child labor was being banned. And they were hearing, and they would rush outside, and they would see human beings, men, flying through the sky, and they would know that someday they would, too. And all of that came to a head, and then the Titanic sinking in 1912 gave us a little hint of what was to come. But in 1914, it all came crashing down. Oh, progress didn't stop. Technological advancement didn't stop. But the mood of the 20th century actually took hold then. And the mood was sullen, no longer naive, no longer optimistic.
And innocence lost, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The lost generation of Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, and all that sort of thing. Even after the war, you know, World War I ended, there was a lot of cynicism in the world. Psychoanalysis and the modernist architecture and the philosophies of existentialism. On down the line, it became a more sullen time, and then you got into the pit. I call it the concave century, because from the bright hopes of 1910, 1913, we went down, 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 and hit our nadir, our bottom, around 1943. And then, lo and behold, guess what? We started clawing our way back out of hell. And it was slow at first. It was difficult at first.
Yeah, and apparently we blew the gates open with an A-bomb in 45.
Yes, but here's the thing. Around 1945, 46, 47, there were two great scientists on the Manhattan Project who had a big argument, and the public was involved in the argument, too. And one was, without a doubt, a very, very wise man and a saint, a truly, truly brilliant, superior human being, very sensitive man named Robert Oppenheimer, who had basically, you know, got all these disparate scientists to work together and gave us the weapon we needed to win the war. But then he was deeply concerned because this was a terrible weapon, and never in human history had human beings turned away from using the next horrible thing and then the next. And he thought it inevitable, so he fought for the bombs to be put under international control. And if you were around then, you'd probably have agreed with him, because his opponent in this debate was a guy named Edward Teller. And Dr. Strangelove was modeled after him. Really crazy Hungarian fellow, kind of a maniac, brilliant, the inventor of the hydrogen bomb. And what Teller did was he made a wager. He said, no, this time is different. This time this thing is so terrible, and if we make it more terrible, it'll do this job even better, that for the first time human beings will be scared out of their ancient love of war, and that they'll instead step back, and that the fear of the other guy having this bomb will result in peace. Well, who'd have thunk that the saintly, extremely expert, erudite guy who knew a lot of history, if you had been there, if you knowing what Oppenheimer knew about history, about human beings, of course you'd bet that we would behave exactly as our ancestors behaved. Oh, you'd have thought Teller was crazy for saying, no, this time we'll grow up a bit, not all the way, but we'll grow up just enough because of mutual assured destruction, you know, fear of both sides having the bomb. Who would have thought that the mad Hungarian would be right? But that's exactly what happened. My generation, I'm 60, my generation was scheduled in the normal rhythm of human affairs. To virtually all of the males in my generation would have died in some conventional World War III. but it didn't happen. And I'm alive and my kids are alive because Teller proved to be right. We humans are obstinate. We're sanctimonious. We're mean cusses, but we are capable of learning.
Yes. Capable of sweetness at times.
Oh, sweetness, sure. No, it's never been that we're all evil. It's just that we're so mercurial that the good was always balanced by equally extravagant bad. And we had to somehow curb the worst. And somehow we did. I'm not saying it's all sunny and light. I'm not saying that we don't have a long road ahead of us. By all means, we've got to get a lot better or we will all die.
But, I got you.
But the thing is, listeners ought to keep a pencil nearby because I'm going to say a few things that they ought to copy down. And one is Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And this is a really, really important book that's been out recently, P-I-N-K-E-R, Pinker. And it just lays out the absolute proof of something that people on the right and the left don't like to hear. And that is, a couple of things have gotten way better. And one of them is violence in the world. Violence on planet Earth among human beings has plummeted every decade for the last 60 years. And we don't think that that's true because we see violence all over the place in the media. And we fail to connect the dots. One of the reasons violence has gone down is because we see it in the media and feel bad about it. That's one of the reasons why poverty has gone way down, is because we see it in these new media, you know, first radio and then newsreels and then television and now the internet. We feel bad about it. It's a problem to be solved. And lo and behold, imperfectly, step by step, it has been solved. Even our standards of what war is like. These recent Middle Eastern wars that we're involved in were terrible, and in many ways terrible mistakes, and they cost us $6 trillion. And we can go get into the politics of all of that and the stupidities of all of it, but the simple fact of the matter is, day by day, they were operated more like SWAT team operations than what, you know, my generation experienced as war in Vietnam, which was itself considerably more meticulous and careful than the horrors of the Korean War or the World War II, in which we sent bombers over whole cities and set them on fire, killing 100,000 people in a night.
Sure, storm the beaches of Normandy and just thousands of men just mowed down.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that we're better people than the greatest generation, our parents who fought World War II. They're the ones who laid the stage for and made the wealth that enabled our generation to then take on a lot of old evils that every previous human generation took for granted, like racism, sexism and environmental neglect and all those things. We couldn't have been able to take them on if we had been poor, because poor people worry about where the next meal is coming from, and they don't expand their horizons of inclusion. They don't expand who they want to include as the next group to be included by the firelight and welcomed by the firelight and welcome to be called citizens and brothers. Well, part of our obsession for the last 60 years has been this process of expansion, of inclusion, so that now, you know, it's considered a bad thing not to include somebody because of his race, or not because, or including somebody as an adult because of her gender. I mean, these are considered bad things. We still do it. We're not perfect. But now we feel ashamed. And that's progress. That's the next step. I don't want to give an impression that this sci-fi author, you know, who's babbling away on coast to coast, is this flaming optimist who thinks people are wonderful. Actually, I'm a bit of an optimist because I know people are rotten. And yet I look across all of this horrible human history and I look at the life that I've lived and the opportunity to live in this culture, and I realize we are capable of beginning to get things right.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. It really does.
Yeah, it's the only conclusion that anybody can reach. Because, you know, and then what's so galling is this insane culture war in the United States of America. When things are actually even still in a recession, or we're not still in a recession, but even still not fully recovered, even with the problems we have, these problems would have made our parents and the greatest generation guffaw in ridicule over how sanctimonious and self-righteous and angry we are over these things. It's ridiculous. We, you know, lots of stuff is better.
You know, a lot of people's biggest problem is that they have no big problems.
Well, I think what they... I'll tell you what, I was invited because I wrote a paper, a scientific paper about this, and I was invited to the Centers of Disease Control back east, the Drug Addiction, National Institutes on Drug and Addiction. And I gave a talk about this at their invitation, and it basically has to do with what is the worst addiction in America today. And you might think heroin, cocaine, what alcohol. But in fact, if you study what addiction is a normal process in normal human brains. It's just what you're getting addicted to. People lose control over it. You're supposed to be addicted to love, as the song goes. You're supposed to be addicted to your children. You're supposed to get addicted, in a sense, to your professional skill. There's nothing a male human especially can gain more pleasure from, other than family life and all that sort of thing. But women, too, just as, you know, women and supposedly, you know, are more addicted to their kids than fathers. Well, not by much. And but there's nothing like the addiction, as you very well know, to your skill. These are all the wholesome things that we're supposed to be addicted to. And if you have these things in your life, you tend to be less susceptible to heroin and cocaine and those things.
Yeah. Well, the definition is an unusually great interest in something.
Yeah, yeah. Although it keeps bringing you back. You have to keep going back to it. Well, you have to go back to give your kids hugs. Nobody's going to pass a law against that. Nobody's going to call you an addict. But, of course, you know, it's exactly what you are. And that's fine. What heroin does is it hijacks the portions of the brain that do this process of addiction to good things, and instead makes you addicted to something that you know, have to pay $500 a capsule for, you know, for your habit and commit crimes and all those horrible things. Well, it turns out that there is an addiction that's worse on America than heroin, cocaine, and alcohol combined.
Yes.
And it hijacks these same processes in the brain, and it gives human beings, many of our fellow citizens, great pleasure, and they have to come back to it and back to it and back to it and back to it.
Do you know what? I'm tempted to just ask you to wait until the other side of this break, because before you reveal what the great addiction is, because I have a feeling that the thought behind this submission is pretty large. Am I close? Okay. He didn't say anything, so maybe it is. All right, let's take our break and then come back, and let's hear the... I'm ready for the revelation. What is the biggest addiction that we have right now? Bigger than heroin, bigger than all of them. As we carry on through the night with David Brin, welcome back to him after 14 years on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back with David Brin in just a moment. And by the way, somebody said, you're telling us what to eat now? And I went, no, I'm not telling you what to eat. And this is based on the interview with David Simon at the beginning of the program. You have revealed your true colors. It's like, look, I don't care what you eat. How could I tell you what to eat or care what you eat when I'm snacking on organic frosted flakes straight out of the box and washing them down with coffee? Eat what you want. You are what you eat. And I suppose that makes me, my snack makes me a little crusty, however sweet, and very, very wired from the organic coffee. So there you have it. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. David Brin, where we left off before our last break here, we were talking about addiction and how it is an unusually high level of interest in something, and may as well face it, we should be addicted to love. So then we got into heroin and how it just sort of takes over everything, and you wind up, first it takes your money, then it takes your property and your job, and it could even take your life. I don't think we got that far, but that's where it was going. So what is the biggest addiction that we as a civilization have right now, or at least our neck of the world?
Well, it's especially the case in America, and that's a clue for you. It turns out that we don't need drugs in order to excite the little centers in the brain, the attachment points for molecules that give us the pleasures that one gets from addictive drugs. And I already spoke of how you can do it. You can get these receptors activated in your own brain through certain mental states, being in love, for example, or doing something really skilled, or loving music, getting into the groove, and of course loving your children. Well, there are other ways of doing it purely mentally, and we know of some, like gambling addictions. It turns out that Las Vegas, for instance, the gambling industry, has learned how to judge when you're at a slot machine or even when you're at a card game, when you're getting the right kind of jolts of feedback of winning occasionally that'll keep you there in your seat. And they've got computer programs that track how well you're winning and whether or not you're shifting in your seat and whether or not you're about to get up and leave. Rage is another one. There are listeners right now who are probably fellows who are dealing with that and trying to get their anger under control. But by far the most powerful and by far the most abused in America, that's doing our nation the worst harm, is self-righteous indignation. And what's more is, you know, a large number of you out there know darn well what I'm talking about. If you're not
an individual... David, define that for us. Define that in the way that, so that we don't get the thought through osmosis, but we just get some nuts and bolts here to play with.
Absolutely. When you are self-righteous, when you're sanctimonious, you get the thrill and the pleasure of looking in a mirror and saying, I am so right, and my opponents are so wrong. And it's something that we all engage in because it's really pleasurable. Because this is how we get riled up. This is how our ancestors got riled up, to sharpen those spears and go after the guys in the next valley. And it was really useful during combat, you know, even in our parents' generation. Even now, those of us who, we thank you for your service, who are in the military. But since World War II, what's happened is that the American military has tried very hard to gain control over the emotions and to how to teach the soldiers, airmen, sailors, how to be professionals and to be skilled and to be somewhat detached from the process. And that not only helps them to do their job better, but it also helps them not to commit crimes. But the thing is, you see, we civilians aren't taught this degree of self-control. We grow up encouraged by our movies and encouraged by popular culture to get enraged easily. And you all know what I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about American politics right now, where there's what's called the outrage industry. And sure, it may be a little stronger on one side of the political spectrum than the other, you know, maybe even twice as strong, or maybe even 10 times as strong. But we both know, we all know that it's being milked at both ends of this horrible, stupid left-right, so-called left-right political axis that not one of your listeners could actually define if their life depended on it. But you know, we should get rid of the darn thing because it reduces complex problems to a simple line. But we should also get rid of it for one basic reason, because it's French. But the business about self-righteous indignation, if you're constantly returning to this sense of pleasure that you get from being so right, my side is so right, and my opponents are so universally 100% wrong, there is a real chance that you're a junkie. I'm not saying that your side isn't right. It may be that your side is right about this issue and the other side is wrong about this issue. It may be that in some other issue your side is 80% right and the other side might have only 20% to contribute to the conversation. But the thing is that we're not having conversation. Negotiation is dead. This is not what Barry Goldwater and the way he did politics 30 years ago. It's not the way Eisenhower, it's not the way Teddy Roosevelt. This is not, The Americans have always gone through phases of being sanctimonious jerks and self-righteous. But we can't really afford that right now. We got problems to solve. And many of them could easily be solved if we just talk to each other. But there's a whole industry out there that doesn't want us to do this. And
there's no money in it.
Well, there's money in conversation. You, John, are doing a fine job of dealing with this blathering scientist, science fiction author, opinionated guy who's on your show, and you're doing a fine job, but your audience wants to hear something they hadn't heard before. But we all know that there are other channels on the radio where people don't want to hear something new. They want to hear reasons to believe, reasons to hate. And those radio stations cater to that.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, I'll tell you what. Now, one of our most excellent listeners, a regular back office intel guy, Boffin for short, named Jay, sent a little rundown on some of the 14 years, and you began our conversation with the discussion of 1914, or 1913, actually, and then we rolled into World War One, and then you mentioned 1814, Napoleon, Waterloo. And Jay added 1714, War of Spanish Succession, War in Europe. 1614 was the 30 Years' War. 1514, the Reformation began with Luther's disappointment with Catholicism. And then 1414, the origin of Reformation with the martyrdom of Jan Hus. So,
well, yes, and now also you have the Battle of Agincourt around there, and that made a big difference in the map of Europe. You go back to 1215, and you've got the Magna Carta. But you have to be careful with all this stuff, because what it is it's human pattern recognition. And trained as a scientist, you realize that there's something called confirmation bias, and that is, if you've got a theory, you're going to start noticing stuff that fits the theory, and you're going to be ignoring stuff that doesn't. And, of course, this plays havoc in science, and it plays havoc in our politics. So I didn't go beyond 1814 backwards, because there were lots of other significant events than the ones that Jay mentioned, though it is kind of creepy how important those ones were. In which case, it raises the question for our audience. Well, now it's 2014. What will be the theme of the 21st century now that in 2014 it's actually going to begin? Because, you know, people say, okay, no. The century started on 9/11. Well, that's very parochial. That event was extremely important to Americans. But in fact, our parents in the greatest generation during World War II, they suffered more damage than that in any given month of World War II. And they just shrugged it off and they stood up and they moved on, which is what the people of New York did in 9/11. They stood on top of that rubble, they faced east, and they said, is that all you got? And of course, we did need to go and smack them. We did need to topple the Taliban. We did need to hunt down Osama and all that sort of stuff. I'm no pansy. But the point is that we didn't have to panic. And the panic was very 20th century in its theme. So I don't think 9/11 was the transition point. But what if we're facing the transition point in the next year? Something big and traumatic happens, or else the opposite. What if we were to rediscover the optimism and the can-do spirit of the 19th century? We've had it at intervals during this century. The whole Apollo program was filled with the can-do spirit. Science still has a lot of it. Science is being badmouthed in certain parts of the media. But, you know, you talk to scientists and they still have some faith in the effort to make us bigger, better, stronger, you know, mightier, more understanding than we were before. And there are lots and lots of people who still feel that way.
You know, I won't say his name because it's so unique, it might give him away. S submitted to us that power is the greatest addiction. I suppose that sort of goes, that's part and parcel with self-righteous indignation.
Well, yeah, except that the self-righteousness is available to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And power is addictive, all right, and you just, there's a certain amount to which I have sympathy for people whose professions have got them in a corner because of technology. For instance, the cops out there. You know, they are trying to transition from 6,000 years when the cops were thugs with sticks, doing whatever the local lord told them to do and bullying and beating up on you. And now they are being asked to be skilled professionals while being watched all the time by the cameras. And we'll get to the whole camera thing because, you know, my transparent society thing is one of the big topics I get on shows for.
Oh, yeah.
But meanwhile, you know, you gotta feel sorry for these guys because knowing that they're on camera all the time, and they need to be because we need to make this transition, you know, they might say one thing wrong or do one thing wrong and all the good gets messed up. Well, my answer to that is record all the good stuff and weigh it in the balance. You know, we'll want good cops. We'll want not to toss them out because they made one simple mistake. But the reason why I raise this is you look at some of these guys who get caught with their pants down. You know, Bill Clinton being the extreme example. Well, all across the last 6,000 years, if you got a lot of power, you got a lot of women.
Absolutely, you wore no pants.
That's right. Well, some of the time, we're all descended from the harems of guys who managed to pull off that trick. And that helps explain why we are the way we are. You ladies out there, I'm sorry we're crazy, but, you know, it's partly because we're all descended from these guys. 8% of the males in China have the gene, the Y chromosome from one man, Genghis Khan.
8%?
That was a guy who had a really, really efficient harem.
I'll say.
He was just cranking them out. But, you know, nevertheless, we've got to outgrow that stuff. Like I said earlier, we outgrew the things that the inability to not use a weapon. We outgrew that a bit. And it all relates to one of the things that I'm pretty heavily engaged in, and that's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. And the question that's called the Fermi Paradox, which is, where is everybody? You know, if life is supposedly so common in the cosmos, why have we seen no signs of it so far? And I know that I'm on coast to coast. So even though Art Bell is, you know, no longer running the show, I know that we'll be getting some calls and some texts and all of that from people saying, you know, what do you mean we've seen no signs? Well, I'm perfectly willing to discuss that maybe an hour from now.
Okay.
But the main point is that the Fermi Paradox is, what could be the reasons why life in the universe, intelligent life with technology, might be more rare than we thought it would be? And some of your listeners have heard of what's called the Drake equation, and that's an equation that's used to hold this conversation, and that is, how common are stable stars in the galaxy? How common are stable planets at just the right that orbit at just the right Goldilocks distance from their star? How common are ecosystems on such planets? How common is life? Where on those planets that life develops, what fraction develop intelligence? On those planets that develop intelligence, what fraction develop technological civilization? And what fraction of those survive their crises, like we were talking about earlier, the crisis of nuclear war, or the crisis of being able to manage an ecosystem, a complex ecosystem on their planet without destroying it? And then how likely is it that they might be able to spread? I mean, are starships possible? These are all things that I discuss both in science and in my science fiction novels. And the questions are really, really fascinating ones. 15 years ago, we didn't know about a single planet outside our solar system. You know how many we know about now, John?
No.
Well, we've confirmed almost 1,000. And there are 3,000 candidates that are being checked. And some of them are the strangest beasts. Some of them are weird. We're finding some that might be orbiting in the Goldilocks zones around their stars. And what it means is that factor of the Drake equation appears to be large. So then, what about the next factor? What fraction of these worlds will develop life? Well, you know, it turns out you don't even need these water worlds in the Goldilocks zone, because we now are pretty sure that 5 different moons, possibly 10 in our solar system, are like Europa. They have oceans of liquid water with ice on the surface protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
5. With oceans.
With oceans.
Liquid water oceans underneath. This is the two we know for almost for sure are Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter, and Enceladus, which is a moon of Saturn.
All right, tell you what, we're gonna have to just take a little break here, get some news and some other things done, and come right back. You'll stay with us for a while, I trust. David Brin is our guest, and this is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Good evening to you.